down enough, and let's see. Is that coming through okay back there? Hear me in the back, all right? Good, good. Well, I'm wearing my I'm excited to be here t-shirt tonight. Original was a gift from Jeremy Wilson, and some people kind of took and expanded on it. I showed up in the assembly one Lord's Day there in Bozeman, and everybody kind of had their coats on, which is not super unusual in Montana, but they kept them kind of closed. And then I got up to preach, and they all stood up, and they all had their "I'm excited to be here" t-shirts, and I appreciate that. I usually start a message to some effect that I am excited to be here, because I really am. And of course, it's a real pleasure for me to be able to share here at the Lima Rally, perfecting the saints. That's what it's all about. Well, this presentation tonight is one I actually put together for a presentation we were doing in Great Falls, Montana. We had formed something called the Citizens for a Free America, CFR, and it was something that we were using to try to reach out in the community. And so we did a series of messages on that at kind of the request of some of the young people, and this particular one has to do with education. And I showed it at Hagerstown, Maryland here a while ago, and about a month ago, and got some rave reviews on it, and so it was kind of requested I do it here. So it's not often I get a message by request, so this is this is one of those. And let me warn you up front, you know, this is a rugged message, okay? This is not for pansies. This is coming with some hardcore stuff. The Bible refers to every age as a present evil age, and our age is no different. Sometimes the veneer is a little bit more attractive, but it's an evil age, and there's a lot of stuff going on. And so this will challenge you a little bit, and I can document and have documented nearly everything in here. So spiritual warfare. I want to talk about education briefly in America. In early America, education was done in the homes and in the churches. So it would be not uncommon, for example, a guy with the name Walter Scott to be running a private school in Pittsburgh. In order to graduate from his school, you had to be able to quote the entire gospel according to John in Greek. And that's where the education was done. Okay, so you had men like Thomas Paine, for example. Thomas Paine wrote a little article called Common Sense. It was distributed in the early part of the Revolutionary War. And it's still to this day, percentage-wide, the most massively read article in American history, other than the Bible. Now, if you grab that today and read it, it's college-level material for Americans today, and a lot of college-level people struggle with that. But Common Sense was written for the common man in the street in the early days of the Revolutionary War. Sometimes you get the impression that that they were kind of illiterate people in those days, but they weren't. The Federalist Papers, for example, were written to promote the Constitution, to try to persuade the voters of the state of New York to support the Constitution that they drafted in 1787. The papers were written for farmers. Okay, for farmers. And if you're to grab the Federalist Papers today and read them, most of you have to have a dictionary in one hand and the Federalist Papers in the other, and you'd be challenged at the level of thought. See, I'm obviously trying to make a point with this. In the early 1830s, a Frenchman by the name of de Tocqueville came to the United States of America to try to see the secrets, determine the secrets of America's greatness. And so as he kind of explored, he eventually found himself in the American frontier, which at that time was Illinois and Wisconsin. And he described how he would come up to what he called a rude hut. That is just a rough dwelling place out there where there's a farmer out there clearing off the land and grubbing a living off that land. And he said, but the inhabitant of that hut is anything but rude. He says, he is a highly civilized man, the product of 18 centuries of enlightenment, say, referring to the Bible. And he said, with his Bible and his axe, he conquers the frontier. That was his analysis, published in Democracy in America in 1836. You see, sometimes you look at the modern-day movies, the Walt Disney rendition of Davy Crockett, you know, there's a bar over there and them there trees. That's not how it was. Those guys were literate. They could speak. They could write. The spelling wasn't always standardized as it is today, because it was about this time that Webster started to publish the first dictionary. Davy Crockett wrote a little paper called Sockdolager. Sockdolager. You can pull that off the website someplace. Read it. You're going to find out how educated a man he was. So education in America was a very high level. And the history of America was that people were trained to read and to write and to think so that they could read and understand and communicate the principles of the Bible. That's why it was done. You know, the old New England primer, A is for Adam. In Adam's fall, we sinned all. Just a little bit of Calvinism there. But see, that was the purpose of it, was so you could read the King James Version of the Bible. And you have to be educated people to do that. So that was education in America. That's where we were. Over a period of years, there became a push for public education. The first real push for it was to try to teach Catholics the Bible. The early guys in America felt that if Catholicism came to America's shores in any significant degree, it would be the death of the republics. Because they knew that the Catholics in general were illiterate, by comparison immoral, and did not use the Bible as a basis for their thinking. And so Catholic school, or public schools were proposed then, this is the bait, to teach Catholics the Bible. Now, in about 1835 or thereabouts, Alexander Campbell met in Cincinnati to discuss with a group of people the possibility of beginning a Christian schools in order to teach the Bible. To his surprise, Catholic Bishop John Purcell opposed the introduction of the Bible in the school. Now, Catholics have known for a long time that if you ever get anybody seriously reading the Bible, they're not going to stay Catholic. So he was opposed to the introduction of the Bible in the public schools. Campbell and the others present couldn't imagine even operating a school without a Bible being the core, the basis of your education. What this did is this then resulted in the famous Campbell-Purcell debate that took place in Cincinnati. This comes from Robert Richards in the Memoirs of Alexander Campbell. So, about the same time, he had early socialists such as Horace Mann in Massachusetts. Remember, Alexander Campbell debated one of the famous socialists who started the New Harmony, Indiana colony. So the socialist movement was also cranking up about the same time. Horace Mann was one of those socialists in Massachusetts, and they operated the first what they kind of called common school in Massachusetts, opened in 1835. But at this point, see, all education was still regarded as the special province of the home and in the church in the early days of American history. And the education level was very high. But after the war between the states, the public education really spread, especially to the western states that were just developing. For example, in Montana, every 36 square miles, every township, one square mile, one section of that's a school section. And that property belongs to the public school system. The places like Virginia City, Montana, Virginia City is the site of the world's richest placer gold strike. Placer gold is gold that you dig out of the sand along the creek bottoms. And those places are wild and woolly. Okay, so by about 1867, there were quite a number of children just roaming the streets of Virginia City, and there were two private schools in operation. And somebody got the idea that if we just start a public school, then all those children would be in school. Well, what happened when they opened the public school in Virginia City? The two private schools had to close down because all the students in the private school transferred over to the public school, and all the other kids that weren't going to school, like Calamity Jane, were still running the streets. See, Calamity Jane was from Virginia City, Montana. And so that's kind of what happened, see, is it slowly put the private schools out of business. By the 1930s, then, we began to develop what was called progressive education. We began to enshrine the experts. Guys like John Dewey from Columbia University now begin to be lifted up and exalted as the paragons of information on education. And they began to develop what were called look-say reading methods. I started grade school in 1953, a little place called Ennis, Montana. And my mother taught me to read before I went to school, which was a real blessing. I read Hans Brinker and the Silver Skates out loud to her shortly after my fifth birthday. And so I was, had a jump on it. But I remember going to the public school, and the first day we opened up, and some of you may remember this. Look, look, look. Look, Sally, look. See, spot, run. See? Anybody else have those? Okay. Now, look is the stupidest word in the English language to have as being the first word for a child that's just trying to learn how to read. It doesn't follow any rules. See, the old McGuffey readers, a rat ran at Nan. Okay, that's how it went. It was teaching phonics. See, that's a logical means. See, but they wanted to do away with phonics. They wanted to pretend that they were instituting a better educational system. But what they were doing by look-say, they were having the kids try to memorize words instead of sound them out. And the result is that the kids ended up looking at the first letter trying to guess the rest of the word. Okay, and that's also been augmented by the what's called the whole word method. They're all these same types of techniques. But what they do is they actually produce dyslexia in boys. And they prevent a person from, if you don't know how to do phonics, how are you going to learn how to pronounce Melchizedek the first time you see it in the Bible? And I heard it, Melchizedek, that's a result of a look-say reading method. Okay, and then they took it the next step. See, as educational levels started to decline, they took it the next step. Parents are starting to complain, about the lack of values. So in the late 1960s, they developed something called values clarification. Particularly, a guy by the name of Sidney Simon, based in Florida, developed it. Now, values clarification sounds pretty good. What it is, it's a means by which children come into school, they have repressive values imposed upon them by their parents and by their congregations and by God. And so what we want them to do is we want them to establish their own values. And so these values clarification techniques are something that they sell to the parents as a means by which they're instituting values back in the classroom, but in fact the means by which they actually eliminate any values other than the fact that the child is God. See, that's why, 16-year-old kids, figures he can go down the street and somebody blinks his lights at him because he's not got his lights on, he just blows them away. See, he's had his values clarified for him. That's what's going on. And a lot of these techniques are based on, they develop them. They work with, magic circles and journals and all kinds of things like that. Games that they play designed to actually alter children's mindset. And then when we finally end up with, we've got national education goals. We've established the Department of Education in Washington, D.C., and step by step, you're seeing the more and more control of education coming from the federal level. What's the results of Education America? Johnny can't read, Johnny can't write, Johnny can't do math, Johnny doesn't know the Constitution or the Bible. Johnny is prepared for global citizenship. That is what's happening. So what's behind these changes? See, what's causing them? Well, you have to, look, there's two theories of history. One's called the accidental theory of history. That's what's taught as being the norm. Now, the accidental theory of history is that things happen to happen just because they happen to happen. Okay. Now, what's called the conspiracy theory of history is that things happen because somebody takes the time, the energy, and the money to make it happen. Now, in your experience in dealing with human beings, did we just have an accident that we got together this weekend? Or did somebody take the time, the energy, and the money to plan it and put it together. So you know anything about human nature, you know anything that happens because somebody's pushing it. So why would you think that would change at a little bit larger level? It's not. You know, Franklin Roosevelt, who would know something about the subject, made this statement. He said, in politics, if something happens, you can be sure it was planned that way. Okay. He should know. You know, he wrote the Day of Infamy speech the day before Pearl Harbor. Yeah, we know that now. Okay. So what's going on here? Well, there's a basic principle. It's called follow the money trail. Okay? Follow the money trail. Money trail is always going to lead you back to banking. Now, in Europe, in the middle 1800s, it's a period known to history as Pax Britannica. That is, if somebody started to get out of line in Europe, England threatened to make war on them. They got back into line. It was peace. All right? Now, underneath, though, the banking system is pretty interesting. What you have to understand about banking is, let's say I'm a real poor guy, kind of living, hand to mouth, so to speak, and I need some real money. I've kind of run out of rent money. I got to have it. It's Friday night. Don't get my paycheck till Monday. What am I going to do? Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to run down to my local pawn shop because my relatives won't lend me any money anymore. And I'm going to pawn my stereo system and maybe my computer and an iPod, and I'm going to get enough money to pay my rent. Okay. Now, what a pawn shop is a poor man's bank. See, here's the first rule of banking. First rule of banking is the banker must be able to collect. So if I'm going to, get some money to pay my rent, then the stuff I take down and put on the shelf at the pawn shop has got to be quite a bit greater in value than the amount of money I'm being loaned. If I don't come back and repay the loan, what's the pawn shop owner do? He just sells the stuff. Okay? What's the first rule of banking? You've got to be able to collect. Now, if we're up at a scale and run down and, I need a little bit of money to start a business, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to put up some collateral. Now, the collateral that I put up is going to have less value than the loan that I'm taking out. First rule of banking is, got to be able to collect. I default on my loan, what do? They come and take the collateral, right? That's how it works. Anybody here have a lien on anything? If you borrow money for your car, who owns the car? Bank does. They tell you how much insurance you're going to have on it, don't they? Okay? So, that's at a commercial bank level. Now, what if you get to an international level? What if you're loaning money to countries? What's the first rule of banking? You've got to be able to collect. Now, how many here have seen Braveheart? Okay, remember old Edward Longshanks? Edward I of England? Okay. Well, the Knights Templar made a mistake. They loaned him a lot of money. And then he just said, I'm not paying you. That's the kind of character he was. So bankers learn. That was back in, about 1217 or thereabouts? Maybe a little bit later, 1270. So the bankers learn something. Okay, if you're going to loan money to a king, you better be able to have something hold over the head of that king so that you can collect. Now, if you're going to loan money to a king, what can you hold over his head? Say, I'm here, Your Honor, Your Liege, I'm here to collect. Oh, he says, off with your head. So what do you hold over the head of a king, another king? So here's what's happening in Europe in the 1800s. The National Bank of Austria, which was a large country at that time, was the Bank of Rothschild. National Bank of Italy, the Bank of Rothschild. National Bank of France, the Bank of Rothschild. National Bank of England, Bank of Rothschild. See, some of you are smart enough to detect a pattern there. National Bank of Germany, Bank of Warburg. Cousins of the Rothschilds. Okay. Now, give you an idea how this works. Back in the days when England was at war with France, Napoleon was chewing up Europe. Okay. Well, finally, Wellington meets Napoleon. Duke of Wellington meets Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo. Now, everybody knew that the Rothschild family had a better information system than the government of England did. So, on that morning, little Nathan Rothschild walks out into the basically the equivalent of the British Stock Exchange and takes his seat where he's going to do business. And everybody's watching Nathan Rothschild. Well, he looks really sad. And then he reluctantly gives orders to sell. Sell his stocks. Everybody knew that he knew what the outcome of the war, but the battle between Wellington and Napoleon was. Panic. You know, just massive panic in the British stock market. British stock market dropped lost 90% of its value in a few hours because everybody was convinced that Wellington had been defeated by Napoleon. What they didn't know was that Nathan Rothschild had agents distributed through the crowd buying everything that was being sold. And so the Rothschild gained a tremendous amount of control of the British economy in one fine morning's move. That's how these things work. See, now there were some countries in the world that didn't have national banks at that time. One of them was Russia. They fixed that in 1917. Another country was the United States of America. Now the United States of America had actually had three national banks. They had a national bank during the Revolutionary War. They had the first U.S. bank shortly after the Revolutionary War. It was replaced by the second U.S. bank after that. Now, old Andrew Jackson, old Hickory, ran on the campaign of abolishing the second U.S. bank, and he won the presidential election. And they did abolish the national bank. Now, Nicholas Bedell, who was a Rothschild agent, see, did everything he could to disrupt the American economy and force them back underneath the national bank. But when the public wouldn't go along with it, those efforts were abandoned. The result is then that from that point on, the American gross national product doubled every 8 years. And it did so for almost a century. Nothing like it in at least the recorded history of mankind. Well, in 1902... Paul Warburg landed at New York City. Instead of pushing apples down Fifth Avenue in New York City to make a living, he's going around the country at a salary of $500,000 per year in 1902 from Kuhn Loeb and Company, lecturing on the need for a national bank to control the cyclical booms and busts of the economy. See, his brother Max Warburg running the family bank back in Germany, Bank of Warburg. All right. Now, in 1905, the New York Times started a rumor that Knickerbocker Bank and Trust in New York was insolvent. Knickerbocker closed their doors, their windows for 4 hours, reopened. Anybody that wanted their money got it. But the drums were beating, see, this is the bank panic of 1905, and the drums were beating on the need for a national bank to control the cyclical booms and busts of the economy. 1909, Paul Warburg arranged for a secret meeting on Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia. Frank Vanderlip was there, and Senator Nelson Aldrich was there. Senator Nelson Aldrich, in case you're wondering, had a famous grandson, Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller. Okay. So what they did was they drafted the Aldrich Banking Act of 1909, which would have established a national bank. It failed because of the opposition of President Taft. And so what they did in the 1912 election, they split the Republican Party and they ran Ross Perot. Teddy Roosevelt. Excuse me. I'm getting my history confused there. They ran Teddy Roosevelt, split the Republican Party, guaranteed Woodrow Wilson was elected president. So on December 23rd, 1913, Congress passed and President Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act. Now, Congress, you don't want them voting on anything December 23rd. About one-third of your House of Representatives are standing in the back drunk having a party. It's like, vote, vote, vote. They don't show that on C-SPAN, but that, I know pages that have actually worked there, and that's what they tell me. Goes on. Okay, that's your U.S. House. Hey, if you check the record of those boys in the House of Representatives of Congress, you'd be amazed how many crooks there are there. And deadbeats, okay? You know, that information's available. You can check it out. So what we got in 1913 was the Federal Reserve System. Now, the Federal Reserve System is a private bank. It's a privately held bank. Okay. And it controls the expansion or the contraction of the currency. Representative from Minnesota by the name of Charles Lindbergh, Sr., son flew the Spirit of St. Louis across the Atlantic, made this statement. He said, from now on, depressions will be scientifically created by the moneyed trusts. See, he nailed it dead on. Now, the fifth point, the Communist Manifesto for taking over advanced countries, fifth point, published in 1848, fifth point is this. Centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with an exclusive monopoly. 1913, we got the most important point for imposing communism on our country. At the same time, 1913 was a very good year. 1913, the Attorney General declared various and sundry, differently worded income tax amendments as all valid, and so we got the income tax amendment in 1913. 2 years before, several foundations had been established, like the Rockefeller Foundation, Carnegie Foundation, Rockefeller Brothers Fund, so forth. By act of Congress, after the passage of the income tax in 1913, these foundations are automatically tax exempt. Now, if you wonder what's going on, some of you remember back in the days of Tricky Dick Nixon and Spiro Agnew, you know, Jerry Ford. Well, Nelson Rockefeller, former governor of the state of New York, was being, you know, put before the Senate to see if he should be appointed as vice president. And so his financial information was disclosed. Most years, Nelson Rockefeller paid no income tax. 1 year, he paid $686 income tax. Say, how can that happen? Simple. Nelson doesn't own anything. It's the foundations that own it, and they just control the foundations. So the result is they have billions of dollars. Who do you think the major shareholders of, say, Exxon are? How about GMC? I mean, we can go through a big list. See, and all of that money, when it comes in, is profit. It's tax exempt. And it goes into those foundations, billions of dollars, that they can do with it what they want. See, follow the money trail. Okay, pay close attention to what's going on. So the second point of the Communist Manifesto for taking over advanced countries, the exact quote is, nevertheless, in advanced countries, the following will be pretty generally applicable. Second point is a heavy, progressive, graduated income tax. Once again, Representative Lindbergh was on it. He said what has been sold to the American public as a soak the rich program will become a siphon in the pocketbook of the working man. See, there was some concern about the proposed 0.25% income tax might rise as high as 5% down the road, but the public was assured that that would never happen. Okay. See, something's going on here. How come these guys are exempt and you're not? Soak the rich program? Now, at the same time, we got stuff going on in Russia. Okay, in 1917, Alexander Kerensky and the Menshevik wing, or what's called the Menshevik wing, the Communist Party, overthrew the Tsar. And the Tsar was put to death in Yekaterinburg, east of the Urals. And instituted sort of a republic as a form of government. Well, the Bolsheviks wouldn't have anything of that. Now, Max Warburg, head of the House of Warburg in Germany, immediately gets a hold of Lenin, Vladimir Lenin. Lenin is an exile and a failed 1905 revolution in Russia, and he's in Switzerland. Max Warburg puts linen, $20 million in gold, and 20 men inside a sealed railroad car, which is shipped all the way across Germany. Okay, now, Germany is at war with Russia during World War I, shipped across the both of the lines, you know, across the German line, across the Russian line, into the city of Petrograd. Okay. At the same time, Jacob Schiff, who was John D. Rockefeller's do-everything guy, gets a hold of Leon Trotsky. Leon Trotsky is an actor on Broadway at this point. He also is a refugee from the failed 1905 rebellion. Okay. Trotsky, $25 million in U.S. cash, at that time as good as gold, and 25 men are put on board a boat headed for Petrograd. So when Lenin and Trotsky and the men and the money get together, then you have the Bolshevik Revolution of the October Revolution. See, what's the name of the hotel you guys stay in, Steve?
Oktoberski.
Oh, can you believe that? That's where it comes from, all right? So the October Revolution, see, was the Bolshevik Revolution. And for 5 years, and Lenin, the men that were with him, made sure no trains ran, no gardens were grown, no crops were harvested. If you were alive in 1922 in many places in Russia, it was because you had eaten members of your own family. Okay. These are the type of monsters that we're dealing with here. Now, you have to try to understand, okay, communism is not the uprising of the poor and the working class. Communism is a means by which the super rich impose tyranny upon the working masses. And you can establish that every communist revolution, every communist dictatorship ever established in the world is financed by the super rich. See, make no mistake of what you're dealing with here, okay? Somebody say someplace, the love of money, root of all sorts of evil, that should follow that money trail, all right? So, let's say the Communist Manifesto, written in 1847 by Karl Marx and Frederick Engels. Frederick Engels is a wealthy industrial manufacturer, and he's actually the one that inserted the 10 points. There it is, point number 5, National Bank, point number 2, Progressive Income Tax, point number 10, Free Education for All Children in Public Schools. What's that doing in there with those other ones? There's a reason. There's a reason that's part of the Communist Manifesto. Now, we had a ruckus in Montana in 1983 where the Montana State Legislature was trying to control Christian schools, private schools, and homeschools through the Office of Public Instruction. And so many of us went down. In Montana is a small state population-wise. You can actually go in and anybody can testify on any bill at the state legislature, which is really nice. And so there was some ruckus. I kind of made, third page of the Montana state newspapers over some statements that I made. And so a radio announcer came, to interview me. And he started his radio interview this with these words. He said, "Now look, the U.S. Constitution guarantees us free education for all children in public schools." And I said, "Wait a minute, sir." I said, "The U.S. Constitution doesn't say anything about education. That's something that's left to the states or to the people, respectively. Okay, but there is a document that speaks about free education for all public schools. Do you know what it is?" He said, "No." I said, "The Communist Manifesto." See, public education is a core part of the establishment of dictatorship. It's a means by which the upcoming generations are programmed to be excellent slaves inside the state system. See? Now, you've got to remember, 1913, that was 4 years before the Communist Revolution in 1917. Communism does not come from Moscow or Beijing. Communism comes from London, from Paris, from New York City, and from, to a lesser degree, Washington, D.C. So you have to understand that. Now, see, there's two things going on at the same time. Violent revolution is communism. That's overt. That's the guys marching in the streets. That's the people getting their heads beat in as the blood flows. That's what that is. Okay. There's also what's called the Parliamentary Revolution. That's underneath. That's what they did in Czechoslovakia. The Communist Party theoretician Jan Kozak, after the fall of Czechoslovakia to communism, wrote a book called Not a Shot is Fired, in which he documented the techniques that they used to what he called the push from below and the push from above, in which, above, in which they squeezed the freedom out of the Czechs. It was after the revolution, after the parliamentary revolution was over, then the Russian tanks rolled in to keep the revolution. Now, the big founder of parliamentary revolution was Cecil Rhodes. And what he established was roundtable societies and things like Rhodes scholarships at Oxford University to train young men, see, to prepare them to be active advocates of the New World Order at a very high level, and to guarantee them excellent and well-positioned, well-placed positions, see, in the world affairs. It's interesting, see, that the founder of violent or overt revolution, Karl Marx, was a practicing Satanist. Okay. This is documented by Richard Wurmbrand, who himself spent about 13 years in a Romanian prison. Okay. Cecil Rhodes, the founder of parliamentary revolution, is a practicing Satanist. See, don't try to say, see, that politics and religion are two separate categories. Do not say that. All politics ever is the application. It's just religion applied. And the only question is, which religion are you applying? Right? After World War I, President Wilson had tried to push what was called the League of Nations. It was apparent that the United States Senate was not going to ratify the League of Nations as a treaty. Immediately, in England, something called the Royal Institute for International Affairs was formed. The United States had a counterpart organization called the American Institute for International Affairs, founded by Edward Mandel House, Christian Herter, John Foster Dulles, and Alan Dulles. Okay. Now, very shortly, the American Institute for International Affairs merged with a small debating society called the Council on Foreign Relations. It's been known by that name ever since. Nearly every presidential candidate since 1932 on the Republican and Democratic Party platforms has been a member of the Council of Foreign Relations. Every Secretary of State, every Secretary of Treasury, every Secretary of Commerce is going to be a part of the Council of Foreign Relations and or a part of something called the Trilateral Commission. The heads of your major corporations are all Council of Foreign Relations Commission. You can count on the high-ranking members of the Chiefs of Staff are always going to be Council on Foreign Relations members. In 1952, Norman Don, congressional investigator for the Reese Committee, interviewed Rowan Gaither. Rowan Gaither was the chairman of the board of the Ford Foundation and a board member of the Council on Foreign Relations. When asked what the purpose of the Council on Foreign Relations was, this is his statement. It is our purpose to so alter the political, economic, and social structure of the United States such as to be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union. How do you like it that nearly every presidential candidate's purpose is to abolish U.S. independence and merge in something like the Soviet Union? You like that? How do you like it that your key members of the House of Representatives and Senate are members of this? How do you like it that your heads of your news media are always members of this? How do you like it that your key cabinet members are all part of this? An organization with a membership that numbers less than 5,000 would have hundreds of people placed in the most prominent positions in the United States of America. What does that sound like to you? An agenda that works together. One of the things that these men in finance, see, follow the money trail, is they finance the development of organizations like the American Humanist Society and others, okay? Now, in 1933, a group of humanists then published the Manifesto One, what came to be called Manifesto One. Okay, they published another one in 1973, and since then they published another one, haven't had time to document the things on that yet. Okay, one of the signers of Humanist Manifesto 1 was John Dewey, the father of modern or progressive education. And it's been well documented, it's Dewey's mind, it's his thinking that dominates education in America today. Well, what does the Humanist Manifesto have to say? Manifesto 1 says that the purpose, then, is the intelligent evaluation, transformation, control, and direction of all human associations is the purpose and program of humanism. How do you like that? Transformation, control, direction, your marriage, your family, your congregation. You like that? They state it up front. Humanists demand a shared life and a shared world. I love that. You know, I demand that you share with me. You know, we were in Russia. I was with John Dowdy in 1994. We were actually in Petrograd, St. Petersburg. And after assembly that Lord's Day, we had kind of a church picnic. And you know, we were going to play American football. And so there was some food out on the table. And people kept walking by and demanding humanitarian aid. You know, that's humanism. They demand it. How about Manifesto 2? The best option is to transcend the limits of national sovereignty and to move toward the building of a world community. Humanism. Get rid of national sovereignty. You know what happens if the Constitution goes? Well, whatever the form of the Constitution goes. The world community must engage in cooperative planning concerning the use of rapidly depleting resources. The planet Earth must be considered a single ecosystem. Read control all over that. So that brings us to the state of Ohio. Okay, the state of Ohio is core state, key state in this whole thing. In 1976, Levi Wissner ran a Baptist church and Tabernacle Christian School, as it's called, was brought to court by the state of Ohio because he refused to go along with the Ohio's minimum education standards. He said they're humanistic. He said, I cannot meet those standards without violating my First Amendment rights. First Amendment rights, of course, had to do with the fact that the free exercise of his religion couldn't be abolished, okay? And so what happened then was that the Ohio State Supreme Court ruled that Ohio's minimum education standards were indeed humanistic. And so he didn't have to meet those standards. And that resulted then in a lot of freedom, you know, beginning in Ohio and for other states. But one of the things you can find out real quickly is that public schools are the main means of promoting humanism. For example, the Office of Public Instruction in the state of Montana says that every student in every public school is guaranteed a humanistic education. I think if you check the state of Ohio, your other states, Indiana and Michigan, you find a similar statement in their public documents. See, what is humanism? See, humanism is if it feels good, do it. And if it doesn't feel good, don't do it. It's my life. I'll do what I want with it. You only go around this life once, you grab for all the gusto you can get. Now is all there is. Buy now, don't worry about paying later. See, that's all humanism. What humanism does, it makes the individual God. It's like Paul said, they worship the creature rather than the creator who is blessed forever. That's humanism. Right? Now what humanism is, it's the rot then and the warp and woof of society's fabric. That stuff is in there and it's rotting the society out on the inside. You don't think so? 1969, 12% of young couples lived together without being married. By 1995, it had risen to 75%. I don't know what the percentage is now, but I don't think it's gone down any. Okay, that's according to the American Family Association, you know. You wouldn't call that rot? 75%? 50% of America's marriages, first marriages, do fail. 65% of America's second marriages fail. What do you call that? Healthy? Or rot, see? Now what humanism does is it reduces children to the level of animal, intellectually and morally. See, humanism says the dualism, you know, of mind and matter must be abolished. The separation between sacred and secular must be eliminated. All there is secular. All man is a machine. Concept of the ghost and the machine is dead. There is no God. There's no deity that will save us. Promises of salvation, of immortal salvation, are illusory and harmful. You think that doesn't have an effect? Remember in 1982 when the U.S. Supreme Court ordered the Ten Commandments plaques in the halls of the state of Kentucky public schools to be taken down? You know what the Supreme Court's reasoning behind that was? That the Ten Commandments plaques were neutral, but a student looking at them might be induced to read the Bible. If the student was induced to read the Bible is psychologically damaging. U.S. Supreme Court. Okay? How about when they overturned the Texas sodomy laws? You know how the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the laws that had been on books since Texas was a state outlawing sodomy? You know how they overturned it? They appealed to decisions in Europe. Humanism is the national religion of this country. Make no mistake about it. Okay? And Christians need to be aware of that. What it does, see, eventually prepares them for global merger. Does that sound like something out of the Humanist Manifesto? So the result is you have these dumbing down of American children. See, a continual reduction, lowering, 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 down. See, standards through look, say, reading methods, whole word reading. Modern math is where a student knows the commutative axiom. He knows that 9 times 8 is the same as 8 times 9. He just doesn't know it's 72. It's what it is. So they put it through values clarification. See, values clarification, as I say, we're eliminating the repressive values that come with children through their parents and through their churches and their belief in God. See, so we've got to get those out of there. We've got to have them establish their own values. That is, we're making them their own gods. Their God. Humanism. See, that's worship of self. That's what it is. Now, it's done through sex education, drug education, alcohol education, death education. These are tools that sound good. But everywhere sex education goes, what do you think happens? I like to use this illustration. Some of you heard it. I'm going to use it again. Don't think about pink elephants. Stop thinking about pink elephants. No more pink elephants. Stop it back there. No more pink elephants. Stop thinking about those elephants. What are you doing? The guy's doing. What are you thinking about, Grant? Pink elephants, huh? I did this one time. There's a little boy sitting down on the floor real close, and he's kind of got his eyes looking up like this. He said, "Wow, they're really pink." What do you think you do when you bring graphic sex videos in and show them to a bunch of 12-year-olds? How about drug education? Drug awareness, resistance education. I was talking to a Christian, a policeman in the city of Eugene, Oregon. And I was telling him, I said, "Jeff," I said, "everywhere DARE goes," I said, "drug usage goes up." He said, "Man, I have a hard time believing that." I said, "Well, just think about it. Drug awareness, reason. What do you think is going to happen? What do you think about it? That's where your mind going." And about that time, then, results just came in from the California DARE program that showed that drug usage did not increase in the inner cities because of all the kids in the inner cities were already aware. But where drug usage increased pretty graphically was in the suburbs. That's what's going on. It's not to make children abstinent. It's not to make the children non-users. It's not to keep them from drinking. It's not to keep them from committing suicide. These things are just techniques to get inside the kids' brains and move them over to where they're full-blown humanists. That's what's going on. And it sounds good to the... See, the goal is to snow the parents and to snow the kids at the same time. And to accomplish an agenda underneath. Wherever drug education goes, what do you think? wherever alcohol education goes. What do you think about alcohol abuse? How about death education? You know, you write your own epitaph enough times in class, what do you think you're going to do? Hang yourself in the rafters of the gym and want to be buried, you know, at the state funeral, you know, your casket lay in the middle of the gym floor. That's what's going to happen. Teachers used to be called teachers. Now they're called change agents. That's their own term for it. Facilitators. Facilitate change. See, if you read the next recommendations for your next public school superintendent who's applying for the job, he's going to tell you that he's highly recommended as a change agent and as a facilitator. That's what he is. Okay. What kind of change? Well, they take these kids with these repressive values coming in from their parents and they unfreeze them. That's why they use the magic circles. That's why they use the journals. All these little techniques. Get the kids to talk, start talking about what's going on, what sort of values. And the teachers are actually trained. My daughter was being trained to be in education and child development. And she'd come home from college and she'd say, as a lot of you know, Lori Shanahan, and she'd say, "Hey, Dad, guess what values clarification technique I learned today?" I had another teacher, she didn't know. I said, "Pam," I said, "look at all this stuff. This is values clarification techniques. This is what it's for." She said, "Oh, I didn't know." Didn't know. She just thought she was using latest teaching methods. What they do is they unfreeze the kids, okay? Get them relaxed a little bit, get them loosened up, get them open up. Then they change them in the middle school years. And in the high school age, they refreeze them. And by this time, they're full-blown humanists. That's why the 16-year-old kid comes home, grabs the keys off the car, off the fridge to the car, says, "Hey, see ya, Dad. It's my life. I'll do what I want. Well, you can't tell me what to do. I am my own person, so back off. You and God, just back off. Back out of my life." That's humanism. See, that's what's gone on. It's deliberate. It's deliberate. Follow the money trail. Children are actually called targets. How do you like the idea of children being called influence targets? This is all documented in a book by Barbara Morris on change agents in the public school. That brings us to Goals 2000. Goals 2000 was passed by the U.S. Congress back in about 1993. It's kind of pushed through by President Bush. If my memory is correct, it was signed by Bill Clinton. Goals 2000, it was called. There's actually three special separate acts here. Albert Schenker, a former president of the American Federation of Teachers, the second largest union, the largest teachers' union is National Education Association, he said it was the most significant piece of education legislation we've ever had. Okay, what's happened? Education is being transferred to the federal government control. That's what's going on, see? So, by the year 2000, all children in America will start school ready to learn. Will, okay? By the year 2000, the high school graduation rate will increase to at least 90%. Students will leave grades 4, 8, and 12 having demonstrated competency. Every school in America will ensure that all students learn to use their minds well. U.S. students will be first in the world in science and mathematic achievement. Every adult American will possess the knowledge and skills necessary to compete in the global economy and exercise the rights and responsibilities of citizens. That's the text of the law. Every school in America will be free of drugs and violence and will offer a disciplined environment to learning. Yeah. Remember, national goals require national controls. So note, New America says that the law says all children, every school, every adult, and uses the imperative will throughout. So we just say, Sieg Heil! Law, 1993. My memory is correct. The goals are voluntary. As in voluntary taxpayer. You know, I mean, your forms come every year, right? What do they say? Voluntary? The little letter from the commissioner? Voluntary taxpayer, see? Outcome-based education. It's the EDUCAT's double talk. See, it's the idea that they're going to continue to worsen the education. It's the means by which they're going to continue to prepare children to be cattle, to be herded into the collectivist corral. back to basics. Talk about back to basics, for example. Not back to basics at all. It's just things that they talk about while in the meantime they're lowering the educational standards, lowering the educational standards, lowering the educational standards. Even call it mastery learning initially, and then it became outcome-based education. What is it? Well, it's based on the work of B.F. Skinner, psychologist, and Steiner and Humanist Manifesto 1. Okay. You know, Pavlov's dogs, Skinnerian psychology, it's all the same. I was mentioning earlier, I think Pavlov's dogs are the hounds of Hades. Any here familiar with Greek mythology? Know what the hounds of Hades are? Okay. Education in America. Early on in these experiments, 1980, the Chicago freshman half, one half failed to graduate. This is one example, but it illustrates these mastery learning results. See, what they're preparing to do is to abolish the high school diploma and replace it with a certificate of mastery learning. And you will not be able to get a job without your Social Security card, your birth certificate, and your certificate of mastery. That's where they're going on this step by step. Here's some examples. This is out of the state of Oklahoma, official policy. The student will develop communication skills, including being able to talk with one's actual or potential partner about sexual behavior. That's what you want your junior high students talking about, right? All students will make environmentally sound decisions in their personal civic lives. That's out of Pennsylvania official policy. The real desired outcome of the OB elitist is a deliberately dumbed down, easily managed, and controlled global workforce of compliant automatons. We have enough education to be able to perform your job, but not enough to be able to think clearly. This is a letter by Mark Tucker of the National Center on Education Economy. This is a private letter to Hillary Clinton that somehow got published, okay? So what is essential is that we create a seamless web of opportunities, develop one skills that literally extends from cradle to grave. See, who marked Oleg out to be a truck driver from the time he was little, huh? In Russia, huh? Government, right? See, who decided these things? They just give you a test, say, okay, it's you. Okay, you just do it. See, cradle to grave, crafted in the word seamless opportunity, see? They use that then as a need for clear national standards of performance education. See, now we do test them, don't we? What, fourth grade, eighth grade, 12th grade? National test, right? So what happens, see, is your curriculum, pedagogy, anybody know what pedagogy is? Okay, it's how you teach children, Pideon, okay? Examinations and teacher education licensure systems are linked to the national standard. It's a simple question. Are there any programs out there that your high school student can take to prepare them to take the SAT and ACT tests? Any programs out there for that? Yes. Okay. See, the test, what happens is you have to teach to the test. That's what happens. Okay, so once they start having national standards, then everything else is going to be linked to that national standards. How the controls are being imposed is through the testing. Now, if you don't have the right politically correct view, how you think you're going to do on the sociology portion of the test? The national standards are Soviet-style education. That's what it is. See, Lenin, in words of Vladimir Tuchinko, his name will tell you he knows something. Lenin could not conceive of an ideal future society without a combination of education and productive labor. Brings us to the School to Work Act. It's already law. It's part of that whole 1993 thing. What they're working on is a planned labor force. In the United States of America, if you get a technical degree, what's happened to a lot of your skills as, shall we say, technological consultant? Anybody ever had this experience? You call up for a little technical support on you know, some of your programs, your computer system, and the voice you hear doesn't speak very good English. Anybody had this? Yeah, okay. So, where are these guys at? Well, a lot of them are Benoy at in Kerala, India is where they're at. But see, what's happened? Not only your manufacturing jobs being shipped overseas, but your tech jobs are being shipped overseas. On top of that, through the various immigration or work programs, they're bringing these guys in under HL and some of these things, and they're educating them, and then they're taking them back so they can open whole technological centers elsewhere. Again, continue to reduce the standard of living. I caught a deal on Paul Harvey, I think it was the other day, said yes, the standard of living has increased a little bit, but it's only for the top 10%. The bottom 90%, their standard of living has continued to decline. Standard of living for a single income family in the United States has consistently declined since 1973. Okay. They want a planned labor force to work in their corporate global system. You know, everybody wears their corporate monkey suits. You guys that work in a corporate, I worked a corporation one time, I know what it's like. You know, corporate politics got anything to do? You know? See, the result is shoving out the traditional teachers. The ones that still want to teach phonics and go back to the real basics, now they're getting shoved out, see? And this all ties in with that UN-sponsored, let me backtrack, UN-sponsored 1990 World Conference on Education for All. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization is involved in the education system of every country in the world. Okay. School to Work Act, it de-emphasizes facts and knowledge and emphasizes politically correct social, psychological, and global thinking. 10th Plank and Communist Manifesto, let me put the whole thing down here. Free education for all children in public schools. Combination of education with industrial production, etc. That's its purpose, to prepare a group of people that are educated well enough to do their job, but not educated well enough to think. A few more Xboxes, we should get there. Maybe some more PlayStations, huh? Can do it, okay. That brings us to the No Child Left Behind legislation. It provides for the biggest federal takeover of education in recent memory. Federal Department of Education strengthens its hold on local schools. You see that going. It's starting to work through the state legislatures. Forces outcome-based education in every classroom. Children, you're going to love this one. Children teachers may illegally act as their parents. See, this is from Tom DeWeese, the American Policy Center. It's quoted by Hal Phillips, Issues and Strategy Board. President George Bush wants to be known as the education reform president. That's why every year when these things come up, you know, he's got his mugshot right in the middle of it. Okay, more money for education at the federal level. Okay. Plan to test every child, 3rd through 8th grade, working on that, aren't they? Leads to federally dictated curriculum. This is from Peter Hoekstra. It says, we are going to tell local school districts and states the results they have to get, and we're going to tell them how to do it. The bottom line is that this is a significant expansion of federal role. Representative Peter Hoekstra of Michigan, he's opposed to that, by the way. He's just saying this is the result of the No Child Left Behind. How is it we could have Head Start, now we have to follow that up with Nobody Left Behind? Something wrong with that picture here? Head Start, and then Nobody Left Behind. What it is, brethren, it's a war for the minds of men. See, it's good versus evil, it's light versus dark, it's God versus Satan. Who do you think was the first chairman of the board of the Federal Reserve System? Paul Warburg. Surprise. Going around the country, lecturing on the need for a national bank, right? Brother Max running the family bank back in Germany. Who is it that puts up the money to send Lenin into Russia? Max Warburg. Who's the German signer of the treaty, one of the key German signers for the Treaty of Versailles that ended World War II, ended World War I, guaranteed World War II? Who's the key German signer? Max Warburg. Who's the key American signer of the Treaty of Versailles at the end of World War I that guaranteed World War I? Paul Warburg. How come you got Warburgs sign on both sides of that tree. There's a lot of fishy stuff going on at a big level. It has to do with the war for the minds of children, the next generation. I read a book, an American was teaching at American University in Berlin in the 1930s. He saw what was happening. He wrote a book to warn the American public what was happening. And it was published in early 1941. A little bit too late for the warning to get through, wasn't it? See, children are moldable. It's their mind. The devil knows the importance of education, even if Christians don't. This is warfare. This is absolute, total warfare. And Christians need to understand that all your enemies are not Baptists or Catholics, okay? Humanism. Humanism has engaged denominationalism to keep the church busy, while in the meantime, it's climbed on its steed and it's rushing at the church full bore from behind. Our struggle, not against flesh and blood, against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. It's worldwide. Apostle Paul and the Holy Spirit knew that. It takes many for it. It takes every for it. You know, what is the church? The church is an educational institution. What is another name for Christians? Disciples. What's that mean? Learners. This, everything is about education. Make no mistake about it. See, a spiritual battle can only be fought and won on spiritual grounds. The Bible says, finally be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. See, put on the full armor of God, that you may be able to stand firm. See, how to be in the Lord? You need to leave the Lord. The Scripture's message about Jesus, about His life, His death, His burial, His resurrection, His appearance, His ascension to glory, second coming. You need to repent. You know, change your lifestyle and your belief system. Now, see, some of us got Christians nominally, but we're in fact got humanists stamped all over us. How much you watch that box in the middle of your living room will tell you. It's unadulterated sewer water pouring out in the middle of every living room. Idolatry to the max is coming out of that thing. Humanism. Anybody here ever hear the word diva? What's a diva? Goddess. Hindu goddess. See, every Britney Spears out there is a diva, right? That's the word they call it. Idol worship. CNN, CBS, ABC, NBC, History Channel, National Geographic, you know, all that stuff. Anti-Christian, pushing postmodernism, subtly working it in to the belief system, the people. So no longer do they believe there's such a thing as truth. Truth has been obliterated in the minds of people through the education and the media system. It's worked together. When you convince the public that there is no truth, I tell you, I was in a Bible study not too long ago. The lady had a master's degree in ecology and wildlife management. As we're working through some of the evolution creation stuff, she knows me by this point well enough, and I said, Pam, I said, I can establish for you that if 2 plus 2 is always, or 1 plus 1 is always 2, I can establish for you that the Bible is the Word of God. I said, so let me ask you this question. Is 1 plus 1 always 2? She thought, and she said, no, I don't think you could always say that it is. I said, well, okay, how about that this and this is always this? She said, no, I don't think you can always say that. What can you do with a person like that? Nothing. That is a result of this educational system that we're talking about. Master's degree in ecology, wildlife management. The eco-spiritual agenda has a part of this to do. So, see, a lot of us, maybe as Christians, are going to have to change our lifestyle here a little bit. Figure out what's going on. You know, what sort of stuff is being pumped into our skulls. What you focus on long enough, that's where your body is going. You need to confess that Jesus is Lord. He's the only one. Not a multicultural polyglot system. Jesus Christ is the Lord. Early Christian died for that confession. Maybe we'll die for that confession too. You be immersed in the name of Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of your sins, you receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. This immersion places an individual into Christ. Unless a person is in Christ, there are no blessings. He stands in a condemned state. See, if you need to be immersed, get it done tonight. Now's the time. What part of N-O-W don't you understand? Only an educated and moral society can remain free. You have a tremendous need for Monday through Friday educational ministries everywhere we can help establish them. It's the only long-term way we're going to salvage the youth and get them directed in the proper direction. What's it going to take? Sacrifice, sacrifice, sacrifice. Teamwork. Putting together the stuff that sometimes separates our emotional difficulty and all those sort of things. Get it done. You know, it'd be nice to come in here and, you know, have a really high-sounding, powerful message. You know, God is great. God is on His throne. Jesus is alive and well, and that's all true. But that's not the message tonight. The message tonight is that this is what's going on earth. Paul said, we are not unaware. We are not ignorant of Satan's schemes. We need to know what those schemes are. Otherwise, we're going to get blindsided by them. Whose eternity is hanging on it? I'm not worried about my eternity. I believe by the grace of God, I can stand under pressure. I believe that I can stand and continue to proclaim Jesus Christ, to be able to say in the face of tremendous opposition, Jesus is Lord. I believe I can do that by His grace. How about my grandchildren? They get the minds of my grandchildren. What? You know how they used to do it in China? After Mao Zedong took control, they had the kids there in the classroom. They had the children pray to God for a piece of candy. Nothing happened. Then they asked Chairman Mao for a piece of candy. Soldier come in and distribute candy to all the children. What do you think, you know, in a mind of a 7-year-old, what do you think message is being communicated here? We don't use candy in this country. We just use federal handouts. That's what we use. His divine power has granted to us everything pertaining in life and godliness through the true knowledge of Him who called us, see, by His own glory and excellence. We need to escape the corruption that is in this world by lust and become partakers of the divine nature and to lead by example. Questions? As you can see, I have some convictions about this. I became a Christian because I watched David Rockefeller use the Council on Foreign Relations and the United States State Department to influence the elections in Chile, in South America. Anaconda Company had invested $360 million of 1967 dollars to develop Chuquicamata, Chile, the world's richest copper deposit, at least to this date. As a result of that, Chile nationalized or Chileanized Anaconda. Anaconda Company could not pay the service charges on that $360 million debt. John A.B. Place, vice president of Chase Manhattan Bank, a David Rockefeller controlled bank, was moved over as chairman of the board, chief executive officer, and president of the Anaconda Company. In 4 weeks, I started getting David Rockefeller speeches to read. You think that didn't make a 22-year-old young man think a little bit about good and evil? About whether there is a God? Brother, this stuff is real. We are witnessing the wholesale looting of the United States of America. We're witnessing the transfer of jobs overseas. We're witnessing the abolition of our borders. We are being prepared for the establishment of something called the North American Union, in which there's no real border between us and Mexico or us and Canada, and the U.S. Constitution is in effect abolished, and your rights that our forefathers fought and died for are gone. That's where we're at in United States of America, 2007. I challenge you to get into your scripture, become spiritually strong, and then figure out how to go make some disciples, immerse those disciples, and teach those disciples to observe all that Jesus commanded, because that's the marching orders for the church. It's the only thing that will work. But all that He commanded, not just your favorites, not just what you want, okay, all of it. And then you have the guarantee He'll be with you to the end of the age. God bless. Thank you.